Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden. I'm working at
an Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage as parents for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Chuck and Julie Grassroots Show, Truth Straight Up, with me, Julie Hayden. Chuck is on his way. He was at a meeting, so he may be here, he may not be here. But if he is, he'll pop in. Wanted to talk today about a couple things. One, the Sandusky trial, which is coming up, the Jerry Sandusky case. There's a lot of interesting things there. The Lindsey Clancy thing, it's looking more and more like a hung jury. I guess we'll see there. Jacob, you read my mind here. Jacob's like, I don't know what the big deal is with this woman in Massachusetts who killed her three kids. Massachusetts has been known to let murderers off. Ted Kennedy comes to mind. Yeah, we'll get to that in a second, Jacob. But wanted to start off with this Friday, the Colorado Secretary of State has to, I think, finalizes the ballot. And right now in Colorado, it almost seems like there are more ballot initiatives than there are candidates on the ballot. And I submit this is what happens when you have a one-party rule state. When you have a legislature that's completely dominated by very progressive Democrats, who all they do is try to shove very progressive Democrat rot down our throats and don't pass anything that people actually care about. And frankly, you have some, I'm just going to call them lazy rhino establishment Republicans who just kind of want to, you know, go along and get along and don't really stand up and fight for very much. There are those who do. Right. And they're great. And we appreciate them, but they can't get anything through. So the way to get things through in Colorado anymore is with the ballot initiatives. And there are I'm going to just go through some of them because the vast majority of them are basically conservative oriented. And it's stuff we're going to have to be voting on. We've already talked about the two competing income tax proposals. One of them is very progressive. It starts out by saying nice things like, oh, we're just going to tax like really, really, really rich people. And everyone else is going to get tax break. Well, that, as we all know, will end up not to be true. And then the other one, which is the one we would support, is a flat income tax, just keeping the rate flat. It's not clear what would happen if both pass, because they're two separate initiatives. It's not one or the other. They're two separate ones. So that would be an interesting battle. And that's one of those things that's going to be massive court cases anyway. And the legislature will get involved because they certainly don't like it. They don't want anyone telling them how much money they can take from us and how they can spend it. But some of the other ones are one would increase the criminal penalties for fentanyl and other synthetic opioids. I think that's conservative. Mandate time in prison for a human trafficking of a minor. And there are a few here then too that are largely citizen, I mean, not funded by massive other sources, but citizen, true citizen initiatives. One would ban transgender youth from playing on sports teams that are not aligned with their biological sex. In other words, boys couldn't play on girls' teams, girls couldn't play on boys' teams. Ban gender-affirming surgery for people younger than 18. Require that law enforcement notify federal immigration officials when an immigrant without proper legal status is charged with a violent crime. I think Denver actually has a law prohibiting that, right? It's a fireable offense if you're in the Denver Police Department. Establish a right to use natural gas for cooking and heating. Now, you would think, well, that's silly. We don't need a law for that, or a ballot initiative. But you do. These wacky progressive Democrats, they want to ban that, right? They want to ban all kinds of things. They want to ban gas lawnmowers. They want to ban gas. They want to ban single family homes. So, I think it sounds weird that you would need a constitutional right for natural gas. But I think if you want to have natural gas, which pretty much everybody does, that's the way to go. Require that sales taxes on sporting goods be earmarked for conservation efforts. Okay, that's clearly a progressive one. And that would be a nightmare, more regulation, right? If you're a sporting goods store, I mean, what's a sporting goods, right? A sporting goods is like, okay, a fishing pole. Okay, that seems like sporting goods. But what about tennis shoes, right? What about socks? That's going to be just a nightmare. So it's clearly a progressive one. Another one, require additional verification when voters submit bail-in ballots, such as a driver's license number or partial social security number. You know, I think this is my thought offhand on that one, that that's one of those things that sounds good, but I think would probably be very, but people would have to write their license number on the ballot or a place for that. And I think obviously we know the progressives who run the Secretary of State's office and the county clerk's office would absolutely scream and holler over that. Another one would ban congressional redistricting outside the typical once a decade census cycle. That's kind of a fight that's going on nationally. That's a conservative one. The other one can create a constitutional right to hunt and fish. Again, you'd think, why would we need that? Well, you look at where the progressive legislature is going and, you know, we've got wolves now. If you're a wolf, you have all kinds of protections, but if you're a hunter, you don't. And then another one, this is the legislature proposed this one, allow the state to keep more tax money, typically returned under the taxpayer bill of rights, to go toward education. So that's another end run around Tabor that the legislature is doing. What kills me about that one is they want to put more money toward education. Okay, well, they want to put more money toward education at a time when school enrollment is declining so rapidly that schools all over the Denver metro area are closing schools. We Rev goes to school in the Boulder Valley School District. They're having to close 4 schools. They're closing them all over the place, right? Part of that, obviously, is a declining birth rate. But part of that is also, that's what happens when you don't flood the state with illegal immigrants, right? And that's what happens. I mean, why should we be giving this education more money to educate fewer kids? I mean, that one doesn't make sense at all. But, you know, again, giving Colorado, I think that'll very well would pass. But I don't know. The ballot initiatives, I think, have become, I think there's another one that might be on the ballot where they're talking about they want to make the ballot language, this is kind of funny, they want to make the ballot language, it has to be under something that an eighth grader could understand. Well, in Colorado, thanks to the obnoxious teachers unions, it's not really clear what an eighth grader can read, right? Maybe it's a third grader, right? Right now, we're sending kids out of the elementary school who really aren't even coming close to meeting the standards for reading and writing. So I don't even know how they would establish that. And I mean, and that's just another ridiculous one that I think is aimed, that's a progressive one, I believe is aimed at making it harder to get a ballot initiative, on the ballot, right? Because it would give the board, which is largely progressive, the more reasons to go ahead and say, oh, wait, the language isn't right here. So they would reject it, right? And the people wouldn't have time to get the new signatures and stuff like that. And then Jacob, did I mention the SAVE Act? Well, that's not on the Colorado ballot. That's important. I think the House passed that today with the Democrats, but I don't think it's going anywhere, Jacob, is it? Well, I mean, alleged, theoretically, I guess. But anyway, back to the Colorado, just to kind of wrap up the Colorado ballot initiatives. It is, what's happening is, again, as we have the one party rule in Colorado, citizens and other groups, like, you know, hunting and fishing groups, people, I mean, some natural gas, places like that who see what the progressive legislature wants to do are forget trying to, you know, fund candidates because they change every year. And we're seeing what's happening. The Democrats rule everything. So they're increasingly going to the ballot initiatives. What's happening is the other side, the progressives, are increasingly trying to come up with ways to thwart the process, i.e. the ballot language, I think. And again, the legislature is sort of proactively passing regulations and rules and like this Tabor thing, right, to go against anything that the citizens say. My guess is, I mean, it makes it, you know, and I don't know. On the one hand, you could say with some of these things, it might be beneficial to a certain extent, since most of them are largely you know, conservative efforts, it might be good for conservative candidates. On the other hand, it also sort of like some of the gender ones fuels a fire for the Democrats to come out, you know, sort of like an abortion one or something to vote against it. So, and then on the other hand, I also sometimes think it gets so confusing that everybody just votes no. Right. And Jacob says, yes, there was a petition for it. I don't know. And Jacob, feel free to chime. I don't think that is on the actual ballot. I think that maybe, is this one the one you're talking about that require people to provide When they mail in their ballot, like a driver's license number or a partial social security number. I think it's, maybe that's it. I have not seen, and they still have till Friday. I haven't seen a SAVE Act making the ballot yet in Colorado. So I don't know. I think, you know, on one hand, it's good, let the citizens decide. But on the other hand, I think it really increases the odds of everybody saying no, just no to everything. And it takes you, you know, to a certain extent, it takes you so long to fill out the ballot then, right? Because you get the blue book and it, you read that and you're like, what? You know what I mean? It looks like it was written by not AI, certainly not ChatGPT, right? It was written by somebody completely, legalese and lawyerese. Colorado require voter identification for ballot, mail-in ballot. I think that must be this one, Jacob, the one requiring a driver's license number or partial social security number. I think the clerks and the secretaries of state are already jumping up and down about that. And certainly it won't be in place, obviously, for 2026 because it won't have even passed or not. And I think that will be, you know, I don't know. I think that they will holler that, number one, that's too hard to verify. And number two, no one's going to verify that. But at least it's a step. It's a step. And yes, I think you're right. That'll bring out the Republicans and the independents as well. Still, you know, I don't know that it's going to be enough. Might be enough to help like a Gabe Evans, who's in a battleground district in CD8. I don't think it's going to be enough to help, you know, people who are in traditionally Democrat strongholds. I think they're just too strong in Colorado right now. But anyway, that's it on that. We'll keep an eye on that and talk more about them as it comes in. Because sometimes, as often happens, the title, it kind of sounds good and it sounds like a good idea, but the devil is always is in the details. And, you know, so, and that can make a big difference. The other thing going on, And Chuck initially wanted to talk about that, but he's not here yet, was the Jerry Sandusky case. So Jerry Sandusky was a former Penn State assistant football coach serving a 30 to 60 year, he's 82, prison sentence, was convicted in 2012 on 45 counts of child sex abuse. Well, next week, there was going to be a court hearing because one of the witnesses in the case is recanting his testimony. Now, keep in mind that all of the, there were like, I think, eight witnesses. There were a bunch of alleged victims, but I think there were, I think, as I understand it, eight, maybe 10 key witnesses in the trial. And although the alleged incidents occurred when they were younger, like 10 or 11, 14, they were all adults when they testified. And one of them now wants to recant. What's really interesting to remember or to consider about this is that it's not as if this man now is saying, oh, I lied back then, right? What he's saying is that he does not believe any sexual assault or sexual abuse occurred. And he is saying that he believes that the prosecutors coerced and manipulated him into giving testimony that sexual abuse had occurred. And what's really interesting about that is what we're talking about here is something that they call fragmented memory. Apparently, this is a psychological theory that sometimes when you suffer a trauma, your brain can't handle it, so it fragments the memory. So you just remember bits and pieces, right? We've all had dates like that. No, I'm kidding. In this case, what happened is the process. So he had, when he came forward and is giving evidence in the case and talking to prosecutors and police people investigating it, he is basically saying, well, I don't really remember. I just remember bits and pieces. So in cases like that, the prosecutors would say, well, what about this? Or what about this? Or do you remember this? Right. And as I understand the fragmented memory theory, in some instances, it can be helpful and help a person piece together and come up with an actual real memory, right? But now, as opposed to in 2012, what we also know is what can happen is that whether intentionally or unintentionally, by the people doing the interviewing, you know, repeatedly asking questions, well, could it have been this? Or maybe it was this. The person kind of starts to put together what is essentially a fake memory. I think that not necessarily maliciously, right? But under this repeated kind of manipulation, repeated coercion. I think there's no other word for it. They come up with a memory that they now sincerely believe, right? And then they testify in trial. Well, this guy is now saying that he believes that's exactly what happened. He believes that there was no sexual assault, and that the memory, quote, that he testified about was essentially created by prosecutors. And then he gave voice to it. And why that is so important is if you just have one guy coming out and saying, okay, well, I lied and no, I didn't. Well, you still have all these other witnesses against Sandusky, right? Who, by the way, continues to assert his innocence. But one of the things the judge is going to look at in this trial is, were these same techniques used in interviews with some of the other witnesses as well? And if that's the case, well, that could really raise a lot of reasonable doubt, right? I mean, if you can raise the question that, okay, sex assault as alleged actually occur, or is it, as this one witness claims, simply the result of prosecutors essentially manipulating or coercing the witnesses? Well, that's a significant reasonable doubt question and a pretty interesting one. I know we've seen cases and we've covered cases on the show before where we had a tape one time. It was a kid, not a little kid, but a teenager who confessed to murder. And you could see, and as you went through the whole interview, right? And I think we did it because people were suing the government, the prosecutors on behalf of this kid. They clearly pressured the kid, right? The kid was clearly not the world's brightest, clearly not the world's most sophisticated, and clearly thought that if he just finally said whatever it was they wanted him to say, he could go home. So you could just see him being beaten down. You can tell by his body language, but I just remember it vividly. And he said what they wanted him to say. And they were like, okay, good, we have a confession, right? Well, and we've seen, and Chuck goes off on this, where prosecutors totally manipulated and it's leading questions. And I think particularly I've covered a lot of child sex assault cases and trials, and they have to be really careful how they word stuff because kids don't really understand what they're saying. Sometimes you see little kids are distracted, they're tired, they're hungry, they're whatever, and they just kind of say, once again, whatever it is they think you want them to say. Add to that the money thrown into the case. Penn State paid out, I think, $130 million to the victims in this case. The witness who is recanting his testimony had not hired a lawyer. The payments didn't occur until after the trial, but had not hired a lawyer. But several of the other witnesses had hired lawyers even before the trial. Well, that certainly, if I've hired myself an attorney and I know that I'm likely to get a big payout and the prosecutor is helping me piece together my fragmented memory, well, that certainly raises a lot of questions. And I found this guy, John Ziegler, he's a podcaster, has done a lot of work on this, and he talks exactly about this. So, Doug, if we could please play the Sandusky soundbite.
Let me deal with both of them. Is everyone lying? The only people that are lying are those that got paid millions of dollars for their testimony. So everybody. Because everybody that testified against Jerry Sandusky, including the main only witness, so-called, former Penn State assistant coach Mike McCleary, all got paid many millions of dollars. And the eight men, not boys, these were adult men from terrible backgrounds who testified against him, all got paid many millions of dollars. And let's be clear why everyone believed them. Everyone believed them for two basic reasons. Number one was the moral panic that caused Penn State to fire Joe Paterno and therefore be perceived as pleading guilty when they didn't know what the heck they were even talking about. Jerry Sandusky had not coached at Penn State for well over a decade at that point. Penn State's Board of Trustees had no clue other than the fact that the media was bearing down on them and they needed to do something. So they got rid of a very old coach, Joe Paterno, just before a home game that was going to turn into a PR disaster for them. Once Penn State is perceived as pleading guilty and they pay out $130 million without any vetting whatsoever, it's all over. There's no chance for Jerry Sandusky to get a fair trial.
Yeah, so we'll have to see. This is really interesting for a number of reasons. I think one, again, you kind of look at, and I think we'll get Mark, he doesn't know this yet. Try to get Mark Pop on next week after the hearing, just talk about what happens. Because You know, we've again, and I have lawyer friends who talk about the way that lawyers handle questioning. And I listened to a recent one. My friend was had a trial and I was listening to it. And you could tell in the interview with the police officer, right? It was a guy who accidentally shot his wife, right? And now I think he ended up being convicted of criminally negligent. I don't even know what it was. It was a much minor because they were both drinking and handling the gun, right? But they were initially trying to charge him with murder, and it was clear that he was completely, I don't know how to say it, overwhelmed. His wife had just died, right? And they were asking him questions, and he's like, I mean, he felt bad, right? They're like, you feel bad? And he's like, I feel terrible, right? And then in trial, they turn around and try to say, see, he's admitting guilt. And it's like, no. And so, you know, you have a lot of these legal prosecutorial shenanigans that go on. And now this is back in 2012. So I'll have to, you know, see what people remember or don't remember or what still exists. But I think it's going to be very interesting to see how much from, you know, what we will find out in the testimony, did the prosecutors help the one witness at least, you know, piece together a memory that he initially started out saying he did not have? And how did that turn into a very specific memory, a very specific sexual assault, to which he now says, you know, no, I don't think that ever occurred. I think that they just, you know, manipulated me and they kept asking me enough questions. And then at the time, I can convince myself, okay, this is what happened. And then once you say that, you know, you can't turn around, particularly when there are millions of dollars on the line, you can't now turn around and go back and say, oh, actually, I didn't. The only other thing, too, that I'm kind of curious about, and I always ask these questions, is why now? What's going on now that this guy is coming forward and saying this? And I don't know. Jerry Sandusky is an 82-year-old guy in prison, clearly, at least right now, for the rest of his life. And maybe there's nothing there. Maybe it was just, you know, his conscience and he just felt, hey, look, now is the time to come forward. But I always wonder. I'm just always sort of cynical about that. And then finally, because I'm going to have to cut it short today, I said, Chuck clearly is not here from his meeting. I have to, once again, go get Rev, which I'm happy to do. But I wanted to talk just a little bit, again, about the Lindsey Clancy case. Because it looks as if the jury again sent out a second time a note. This is a woman who's accused of killing her three kids, which Jacob referred to at the top of the show, sent out a note saying we can't reach a verdict. And the judge twice has sent back a note saying, essentially, and I've seen this, they have a different word for it in Massachusetts, but I forget what it's called in Colorado. But the judge basically says, you know, without compromising your position or your beliefs, you know, please go back and listen to each other and see if you can reach a verdict. And I think the judge does that for a couple of reasons. One, they wants to let the juries know you really have to try, right? We don't want to have to go through all of this again. And you don't just get to say, oh, well, too bad, we can't decide. As a reporter, this was, how do I say it? It's not usual, but it's also not unusual. And I saw it go both ways. I think sometimes the note goes back, you know, the judge note goes back and the jury is like, okay, we're not actually going to just all get to go home now. We have to try. And so they do have discussions. In other cases, I think it comes back right away. It's like what's happened is it's 5 days now. All sides can be somewhat entrenched in their beliefs, right? They've been arguing their case now for 5 days. And so it doesn't change. I think it is highly unlikely a judge will send it back another time. I don't know. And, you know, time could prove me wrong. But usually if they come back again, you know, it would be a mistrial. I think in this case, once again, not to harp on prosecutors, but to harp on prosecutors. I mean, the prosecutors gave them everything from first degree murder, second degree murder, criminally negligent homicide, not guilty by reason of insanity, and not guilty. Now, it's turned into a sideshow outside of the courtroom where I'm not sure why, but all these feminist groups, well, I know why, because they're crazy. I can take that back. All these feminist groups and woke people are harping on this, again, saying that the mother's the victim, ignoring the fact that the three dead children are the victim. And, you know, it's important to keep in mind a sad fact, and that is that most children who are murdered by their parents or parent, or by a close family friend, right? More than they are by strangers. So the concept that someone would murder their children or they must be insane is not necessarily the case. On the other hand, this case has a lot of medication. She tried to kill herself. This certainly, I mean, I've covered trials where, horrific trials, where parents have killed their young children simply out of selfishness, right? Because they just didn't want to deal with them anymore. They had a new spouse or a new girlfriend who didn't want to deal with them anymore. Horrific cases, right? Those people get convicted of first degree murder. I didn't cover this trial or follow this trial all the way through, but it certainly doesn't seem to me to be a first degree murder case, right? This seems to be a horribly, throw the woke circus aside, right? Throw that out. This seems to be a horribly sad, tragic case. So I don't even know why first degree murder. I don't even know second degree murder, right? So who knows what the jury is hung up on? My guess would be not guilty by reason of insanity or just not guilty at all. Because those are kind of, in a way, basically not that different. And it's hard when you cover insanity things, it gets very technical about what is or isn't insanity. And frankly, what we're seeing, we talked about this the other day, we're seeing this whole jury nullification anymore, right? Where jurors are like, hey, I don't care what the law says. I'm just going to do what my gut tells me, which on one hand is kind of good. And on the other hand, it's kind of like, well, why do we have trials? Why don't we just do surveys and let people decide? So we'll see what happens with that, though. I know her lawyer has indicated that he said she would not survive another trial. So I guess that means they would plead guilty. But he doesn't think that the prosecutors will back down. So we'll see on that. That is all I have for today. Like I said, I kind of apologize for cutting it short. We have to do some running around. And I'll just kind of end on this. It's kind of bittersweet for me. In a few months, Rev gets his license. Then I won't need to do this anymore, but I'll also kind of miss doing it. I think anybody who's a parent out there can relate to that. So thank you to the guys at PBS. Thank you, everybody on Zoom. We'll be back Monday with a full, complete show. And everyone else, have a good rest of your week. Bye-bye, everybody.